Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. It's been a week of fighting words and some serious defense, both in the skies and in the campaign. Barack Obama is on a winning streak, but in last night's debate, Hillary Clinton tried to win back some points, accusing Obama of plagiarism.
You know, lifting whole passages from someone else's speeches is not change you can believe in, it's change you can Xerox. And well, I just Barack, it is.
The U.S. military shot down a failing satellite. Defense Secretary Robert Gates said it had a message about America's missile defense system.
To underscore that the money that the Congress has been voting for this has resulted in a very real capability.
And John McCain responded to a controversial New York Times article suggesting an inappropriate relationship with a lobbyist.
People who represent interests are fine. That's their constitutional right. The question is whether do they have excess or unwarranted influence? And certainly no one ever has in my conduct of my public life.
This hour, On Point, our weekly news roundtable dives into the big stories this week. Joining me now from Columbus, Ohio, where a big primary is taking place in just 10 days, is Jean Cummings, chief lobbying and influence writer for The Politico. She has covered five presidential campaigns. Jean, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me, Jane.
Joining me also from Washington is David Ignatius, columnist and associate editor at The Washington Post. He is co-creator and co-moderator of Post Global, which is an online forum on international affairs at WashingtonPost.com. David, great to have you. Thanks.
Hi, Jane.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, is Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst and senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly magazine. Jack, hello.
Hello, Jane. Jean and David.
So, Jean, start us off. Fresh off the Democratic debate last night between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, what did you make of it?
Well, I don't think there was a knockout punch, and I'm not sure that Hillary Clinton was able to make headway in cutting off some of the momentum that Barack Obama has from his 11 victories. I thought both of them acquitted themselves well. I don't think that when Hillary Clinton did try to bring up the latest criticism of him with the copying language from Massachusetts Governor Deval's Patrick's speeches, I don't think that worked for her. She was booed by the crowd. That's not a good sign when you got a Democratic crowd out there that's going to the primary in Texas in 10 days, too. Mm-hmm. So I think that fell flat for her. Most things they've tried have fallen flat.
David, do you agree with Jean?
I do. I thought this was Obama's best debate performance so far. In most of the other debates, I've come away thinking that Hillary really cleaned up. You know, all of her strengths, her focus on policy, her articulateness, her confidence have been displayed so well in the debates. And Obama has often seemed to me to be stiff. I thought we were seeing the real momentum that he's got now. He was a more confident candidate. Watching Hillary just sit there, you could almost see her fuming as he gave easy, relaxed answers to questions she thought would get him. I thought her attempt to play the plagiarism card with the speech making by Xerox fell flat. The paradox about Hillary Clinton is that anytime she really lets us inside of that so well-prepared but brittle exterior to see the real person, as she did at the end of the debate, it's really winning. And it's so odd, as we look back on this, assuming an Obama victory, why she wasn't able to surface that real person more is going to be one of the mysteries.
Hmm. Jack, your take on last night.
Well, it was ironic, the plagiarism charge, because in her last statement, Hillary said, the hits I've taken in life are nothing compared to what every single day people face in their lives across this country. Bill Clinton in 1992, the hits I took in the election are nothing compared to the hits the people of this country has been taking for a long time. She accuses him of plagiarism as she's plagiarizing from her husband. I thought her ending where she said, I am honored. To be here with Barack Obama, a gracious end. There was an aura of valedictory about it. that, and I think she was partly signaling, look, I'm going to leave the stage with dignity. I'm not going to go negative. It's not working, for one thing. And there was almost, I could even hear somewhere back there a sort of a proffer to be a vice presidential candidate. But it was a very cordial and almost unusual way of putting it. I'm honored. Hmm. And I feel that she was in a way signaling she knows what the polls are saying. And in Ohio, the distance has been cut in a week pretty much in half. In Texas, a statistical tie. But if you look at the diagram in pollster.org, you got the Obama line is just about ready to cross hers. And from what everybody says, is likely to cross hers.
Jack, let's actually listen to Barack Obama from last night. He's responding to Hillary Clinton's charge that his campaign was all about words and not action.
What I've been talking about in these speeches, and I got to admit, some of them are pretty good. What I've been talking about is not just hope and not just inspiration. It's a $4,000 tuition credit for every student every year in exchange for national service so that college becomes more affordable. I've been talking about making sure that we change our tax code so that working families actually get relief. I've been talking about making sure that we bring an end to this war in Iraq so that we can start bringing our troops home and invest money here in the United States.
Gene, you mentioned 11 straight wins for Barack Obama. Can Hillary Clinton break that momentum at this point?
It's really, really hard for her right now. Because, as Jack pointed out, the polls are closing just as they did in other states. And, you know, it's way back, a week way back, feels like forever, a week ago, I did a story about how she's, you know, like it or not, stuck in the Rudy Giuliani position where you have to take blow after blow and just hope that a big lead holds. And it didn't for him, and it hasn't for her. And I think one of the things that's important about what we've learned about Barack Obama is that while he doesn't go on the attack very often, he is a great counterpuncher. And when she leaves an opening, he can exploit it. And that's what he did in that answer. He went right at the criticism of him that he lacks specifics, that he lacks real policy beneath his rhetoric, and laid out all of those policies that do indeed lay underneath of the soaring rhetoric. He's a great counterpuncher. If he wins a nomination, this is going to bedevil the Republicans just as it has Hillary Clinton.
Hmm. David, what about the Democrats' battle for these unpledged superdelegates and the delegates from Florida and Michigan? Where does that stand now? How nasty is it getting?
Well, we'll have to see. That really depends on the outcome of the remaining big primaries. If Obama wins Texas, it's over. If Hillary narrowly wins Texas and Obama wins Ohio, it's probably over. But you know, I think the issue of the superdelegates and whether to seat Michigan and Florida comes into play only if it remains close. If we have continued Obama momentum, everybody will stampede toward the winner, and that's it. That's the end of the game. But if it's really going down to the convention, the argument that the Democratic voters of Michigan and Florida in some way should be enfranchised, should be part of picking the nominee, will be very powerful. So there'll be an argument for some kind of do-over to give them a voice. The problem for the superdelegates is acute. They're there really to have judgment outside the volatile politics of the base that's part of the primary nominating season. That's what they're there for. But they're going to be blamed if they exercise that independent judgment in a way that seems to contradict what the voters want. I've talked to a few superdelegates, and they're really nervous. Mm. They understand that they might be seen, especially by Obama supporters, as taking the nomination away from the man who won it fair and square. So, I don't think they'll do that. I don't think they'll put themselves in a position where they seem to be stealing the nomination from the first African-American nominee. I think the Michigan-Florida question actually is trickier if it's really close.
Gene, you actually wrote this week that ironically Florida and Michigan could have been kingmakers had they not moved their primaries in the first place.
Isn't it amazing? It's true, though. If Michigan had just, you know, kept its cool, it would have, its primary would have come right after the Super Tuesday tie, and they would have been the biggest prize after that, and a tiebreaker. And Florida would have been gearing up for a March 11th primary. So if they split the difference in the upcoming primary between Texas and Ohio, then Florida would have been, again, a tiebreaker. So it is a great irony that if they had just kept their cool about them, they would have been really big players in all of this.
We talked about the polls tightening up. They seem to be in Texas and Ohio. Is Obama cutting into Hillary's core voters, those blue-collar voters, and women, Jean?
He absolutely is. When you looked at Wisconsin, well, and it's not just Wisconsin. In Maryland, Virginia, and Wisconsin, we have a string of states where he started moving in on her turf, where he took women, where he started to take the working class. When he got into Wisconsin, he took almost all of them. She was left with senior women. She had some slight edges at the lower end of the economic scale, but he won in rural areas, in suburban areas, in urban areas. He split women. He won white men. He was winning across the board. And that is their great fear, because Wisconsin, in many ways, the demographics reflect Ohio in particular. And this, he has done the same thing with Hispanic voters, which were to be her firewall down in Texas. If you look in Nevada, he didn't do so well. You look at California, he did even better. He's inching in that direction again.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking with our roundtable this hour about the week in the news. Joining me today from the campaign trail in Columbus, Ohio, is Jean Cummings, chief lobbying and influence writer for The Politico. From Washington, D.C., David Ignatius, columnist at The Washington Post. And from New Hampshire, Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst. I want to bring a listener into our conversation right off the top here. David is in Cambridge, Massachusetts. David, welcome to On Point.
Yeah, hi, Jane. How are you?
Hi, fine, thanks. Go ahead. Yeah.
I started off as an Edwards supporter, and I'm a Barack Obama supporter now, but I do think the criticism of him that he is practicing kind of a vague, small-bore politics is very accurate. And he's really practicing a kind of Clinton-like politics. Even that series of what were supposed to be concrete proposals we heard a minute ago, a $4,000 tax credit for college, I mean, that's pretty small stuff. I guess I wanted to ask your guests whether they thought in the next few months the Democrats and the media ought to push Obama to get more ambitious and concrete in what he's going to do after he's elected, or whether we should just let him float in on this pink cloud, you know, hoping that he's got a few ideas. And you know, I keep dreaming that he's got some really smart people sequestered in a bunker somewhere coming up with a really ambitious plan for the first 100 days, but I kind of doubt it.
All right, David, we hear your thoughts. Jack, please jump in. I know you want to talk about this.
Yeah, you know, I actually think that that there is something better than particular ideas. He's got lots of those going for Obama. I think he has a political philosophy here. He talks about what he calls the social balance. And he's really making a comment there about how policy, government policy, has been tilted toward the affluent, toward corporations, now really going on, I think, through the Clinton years as well. And he's saying this has distorted the social balance, that in effect the government, rather than trying to mitigate economic inequality, has been exacerbating it through the lobbying, through the favors, through the, you know, the deregulation and so on. And in his program fits together, I think, in a kind of core as a way to restore the social balance. He wants tax cuts for middle-class people and for Social Security recipients. Again, and he wants to take that away from people at the top. He wants spending programs, the medical program, an infrastructure program, other things directed, again, toward the middle and the bottom. He's critical of free trade deals that have clearly benefited corporations and not really working people. And so I think that we're going to hear more and more about this idea of the social balance. And it's a phrase that comes out of John Kenneth Galbraith, used it in his 1958 book, The Affluent Society, where he talked about a society that had, as in the 1950s, private affluence and public squalor. Huh. Lots of rich but terrible schools, miserable infrastructure, and so on. Obama is using it, I think, in a more profound sense, that it's the imbalance between the classes and the way the government has been aiding and furthering that. He wants to reset the social balance. I think that's as big an idea as we've had in American politics in a long time.
Let me turn to Gene. Do you agree with the caller, this charge against Obama having some sort of empty rhetoric? Is it accurate?
Actually, I'm more with Jack on this one. I can understand why the caller feels that way, because there is so much emphasis on the inspirational speeches that come from Barack Obama. But if you look at his policies, I do think there is a mix. I think you have a very ambitious policy on health care, not perhaps as ambitious as Hillary Clinton's, but only by 1%. I mean, they're very, very close to one another with a distinct difference on how they would approach it, but the goal being the same. I think also, here's a guy who says he wants to end the war in Iraq. This is a pretty big goal, too. So you have those two very ambitious, one domestic policy, one foreign policy, goals that he has set for himself to achieve early in his presidency, and then that is packaged with a bunch of smaller, perhaps more strategic hits that are aimed at trying to provide some direct relief to, as Jack said, to a middle class that has felt like it's been left out of the process and, in fact, fallen behind during the Bush year. So I think he has more of a mix of policies, both big and small. Mm.
All right, let's turn to another issue from this week. The New York Times publishing a long and complex story calling into question Senator John McCain's judgment on several issues. And as part of the story, the newspaper revealed that 8 years ago, the senator's staffers feared that he was having an affair with a lobbyist who seemed to show up at unexpected times. Senator McCain responded this week. Here he is.
Obviously, I'm very disappointed in the article. It's not true. As has been pointed out, I've served this nation honorably for more than a half a century. When I was 17, I raised my hand and said I would support and defend this nation, and I've had the honor of serving it ever since. At no time have I ever done anything that would betray the public trust, nor make a decision which in any way would not be in the public interest and would favor anyone or any organization.
David Ignatius, has this story impacted the McCain campaign?
Well, you could hear in the candidate's voice that it's impacted him. The McCain campaign is upset about this. They've been bracing for it for months. They hired Bob Bennett, Washington's super lawyer, to try to take the steam out of this when it first began rumbling along really late last year. I thought the New York Times story was an odd one. It was written almost as an essay about John McCain and ethics. And it kind of coded the hard details in this broader discussion of whether the White Knight on ethics issues was vulnerable because of his contacts with lobbyists, and in particular, this woman, Vicki Eisman. The gossip that's been swirling, suggesting that there was some kind of sexual relationship between them, the Times didn't assert, didn't seem to have evidence to support. It's been denied by both people. When you then look into the details of the story, they're fairly thin. I mean, you know, maybe you could argue that nobody should ever write letters to federal agencies after talking to lobbyists, but every senator on the Hill does it. Some of those details actually are almost 8 years old, came out a long time ago. You know, this is a man who clearly got tied up in improper, unethical dealings as a member of the Keating Five, coming to the rescue of savings and loans. What's been striking about John McCain is that he seemed to learn from that and really has been the leading voice in the Senate for trying to change the rules on campaign finance, on lobbying, so that the things that happened to him, the bad things that he did, don't keep happening. unless there's more to this story, I would think that it would not be in any sense a killer for him.
Gene Cummings, in some way, does this mobilize the base of the Republican Party, unify them? You know, you hear Rush Limbaugh now finally defending Senator McCain on something. Does it do something for him in a way that, gosh, he would never have anticipated?
Absolutely. I think that this attack, they were able to sort of boomerang it in short term in a positive way. They sent out a fundraiser almost immediately, citing the fact that he was under attack from the New York Times, and I'm sure that they raised a lot of money off of that. And it is, you know, no short win for John McCain to have Limbaugh and company, awkwardly perhaps, but at any rate, rallying behind him to defend the Republican nominee against the Times. This after the candidate himself had to awkwardly accept the endorsement of the New York Times not so long ago. But I agree with David that there was the Times story struck me as a little odd in that I think that there is a good government question that one might raise in this campaign about John McCain that can be brought into real life today and not just written with 10-year-old information. I mean, when John McCain was down on his luck in August, who hung around to pull him out? It was lobbyists in Washington. I mean, there is a lobbyist who is head of his finance. His lobbying, his top advisors include several lobbyists. They were the guys who hung around when times were tough. So, you know, you can take this sort of question about his relationship with lobbyists right into modern day. What I didn't get was why you then toss in this sort of salacious, did they have an affair or not? I mean, we had this with John Kerry in 2004. Rumors sprouted up. He said it didn't happen. She said it didn't happen. The story died. And I think in this case, you have both parties saying it didn't happen. You have no proof that it did happen. So why base a story on the fact that some staff members became convinced themselves? Well, you know, that's not evidence. That's not proof that they had any kind of relationship. I thought it was rather odd to just throw in what was sure to be red bait and a target for criticism.
Here's a thought from one of our callers, Mark, who is in Acton, Massachusetts. Mark, welcome to On Point.
Hi, how are you today?
Hi, fine. Go ahead.
Good. You know, this isn't a 9-year-old story. This is the story has to do with why John McCain still feels necessary to misrepresent the propriety of what he did for this lobbyist client. The fact is that when he gave his press conference just a couple of days ago, he said that he did write these letters to the FCC, but there was nothing wrong with it, and that the FCC chairman said there was nothing wrong with it. And that's not true. In fact, on the Politico site, I think, Ms. Cummings, you have the 1,500-word response of the McCain campaign, and they go out and say that they never got a response from Chairman Kennard. Well, the fact is that they stopped too soon. They did get a response from Chairman Kennard, and he wrote to Senator McCain, and he said it was highly unusual for McCain to send such a letter, and he was concerned that it would interfere with the commission's deliberations. Another commissioner, Ms. Tristani, said that in order to preserve the integrity of our processes, it is my practice not to publicly disclose whether I have voted or when I'll be voting. So he is still, to this day, trying to misrepresent the propriety of what he did. It's not proper, and I'd like to know when the news media is going to get past the salacious rumors and get to the substance of this, which is how improper it was and the fact that he was called on it by the commissioner and another member at the time.
Mark, thank you so much for your call. Jack Beatty, did the alleged ethics violations get lost? Did they get the attention that they should have, being surrounded by all the other business about affairs and such?
Perhaps not. You know, I also noticed that he received $167,000 in contributions over, I guess, in the late 90s from the Baby Bells, who wanted deregulation. And he voted for deregulation. He got $20,000 from Paxson Communications, the firm represented by this lobbyist, and rode on their plane. The point is, this is business as usual in Washington. I agree with David. He is among the best senators on ethics and on campaign finance reform. But if he's among the best, look at the standard operating procedure. chairman of a committee dealing with communications and such, taking $167,000 from an interest with, a company with interest before the committee. That's just how things are done. And this is, I think, part of the Obama message. We can't go on like this and have a government of the people.
Another perspective from one of our callers, Tina, is in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Tina, welcome to you.
Hello. I'd like to preface with the fact that I'm actually a registered independent and I tend to lead Democratic, but John McCain, his integrity says a lot for me. And I think it's unfortunate that 8 years ago when he lost the election, I feel like he was undermined by the Republican Party because he can't be pushed around. He's independent. They knew that they could push around Bush. They put him in office so that they could control what he was going to do, and I feel like it's going to be the same thing this time around. Mm.
Thank you for your thoughts, Tina. Jean, does this story have legs? Are we going to be talking about this next week?
Well, I think that the previous caller did make a point that I was trying to make, and that there is a good government story to be raised here with John McCain, and it's the caller was right that the chairman did note that what McCain did he thought was inappropriate, and you can bring this into modern day with the campaign contributions that Jack mentioned, and so I do think you'll see this issue raised. But Jack's also right, this is the way Washington operates, and David is too, in that senators write letters all the time, and oftentimes the chairman don't complain about them. Maybe this is why we haven't had a senator elected for so many years president, because this is the way our system works in Washington. But I think this issue can be raised on the side of John McCain. And the truth is, I think Barack Obama will face some scrutiny as well with the contributions, although not from lobbyists, but certainly from interest groups that he's received, and then what has been his behavior on Capitol Hill.
Before we go to break, you are in Columbus, Ohio, Gene. We're a big primary, of course, taking place in 10 days. And before we run out of time here, I just wanted you to quickly talk about the parallels between Wisconsin and Ohio upcoming.
Well, I think that the big parallel is the economy. It was a number one issue for voters in Wisconsin. It's even higher here in Ohio, which has faced such difficulty and has a higher unemployment rate than the national average. It is a major, major issue here. And so that is a key parallel. The Barack Obama's message in Wisconsin worked for him. And that was when he, for the first time, really cut deep into Hillary Clinton's support amongst those who are stressed economically. So we'll see lots and lots of talk about that here. The other demographic that's important is that you have the number of women voting in the Democratic primary is higher here. And so while he has been able to cut into her base amongst women, if she can hang on to an edge there, that could be an advantage for here, given that the fact that women vote disproportionately in the Democratic primary. So those are some of the things to look for.
David, what are you looking for upcoming?
Well, I'm looking to see if Hillary can hold the line in Texas. That's really the Alamo for her, as people have been saying. But just as we close out on politics, I just want to disagree with Gene and Jack about Obama. I mean, I think Jack's comments in particular illustrate the way in which a charismatic candidate really just gathers this kind of luster, and people begin to attach all sorts of marvelous things to the charismatic figure. Jack's account of what Obama stands for and will do is marvelous. I just haven't heard Obama express it in those same terms. And I do think there's the criticism that this man has voiced a desire for change without being specific about what that would mean, and putting the pieces together is a fair one, and that he needs to do more to clarify who he is.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This week has had some serious headlines, but the late night hosts have been having a lot of fun with it all. First up, here is Jay Leno.
President Bush is now in Africa, where he's meeting with several of Africa's top leaders. Again, I don't think President Bush that familiar with Africa.
Oh, yeah.
Like today said the leader, he's most looking forward to meeting the Lion King.
Here is Conan O'Brien weighing in on Fidel Castro's resignation.
The biggest surprise was when Castro announced that he's going to retire in Miami.
And David Letterman couldn't resist either.
His retirement will not change the relationship Cuba has with the United States. Cubans still will not legally be allowed to enter the United States unless they have an overpowering fastball. Then they can. Then it's fine. That'll be fine.
Joining us today on the campaign trail in Columbus, Ohio, is Gene Cummings, chief lobbying and influence writer for The Politico. From Washington, D.C., David Ignatius, columnist at The Washington Post. And from New Hampshire, Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst. So we heard the funnies, but on a serious note, a lot of international news this week. Let's listen to State Department spokesman Sean McCormick reacting to the burning of the U.S. embassy in Belgrade. Serbs stormed the embassy to protest Kosovo's newly declared independence, which the U.S. is supporting.
Serbia's leaders bear a special responsibility in this regard to not condone or in any way tolerate members of their government inciting others to violence, or in any way hinting that it is acceptable.
And then in Pakistan, two opposition parties defeated Pervez Musharraf in their election on Monday. Former Pakistan Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif shared his reaction to the election with reporters on Thursday.
I think Musharraf is now totally isolated. He said he will step down once the people of Pakistan think that he's no longer required. So he's, I think, the most unpopular man today in this country. So he should step down.
So, David Ignatius, U.S. Embassy in Serbia on fire, Kosovo declaring independence, Fidel Castro stepping down, opposition party scoring victory in Pakistan. Put it all together for us. What did the world look like to you this week?
Well, this was a sign of transition in different and potentially dangerous ways in lots of different countries. You could argue that the movement is toward the light, that this iconic figure of the Cold War, Fidel Castro, is finally stepping aside, that America's cold warrior in Pakistan, if you will, General Musharraf, has been rejected soundly by the Pakistani people, and that some transition process is now underway. I must say I'm not thrilled by the principal political figures of the opposition who are now taking center stage, Nawaz Sharif, who we heard in that clip, and Zardari, the heir to his wife Benazir Bhutto's party, are both old faces in Pakistani politics, are argued to be very corrupt, and but there's change, and there'll be new people coming ahead. Just want to say one thing about Kosovo, because I think it's received too little attention. With our embassy in Belgrade in ruins, it's easy to get furious and line up even more strongly behind the Kosovar cause. But this is, I think, something that the U.S. has sort of stumbled into without fully thinking through the consequences. We are supporting a separatist Kosovo movement, really the breakup of Serbia, despite intense opposition by Serbs who say this is part of our historical homeland, and despite intense opposition by Russia, which feels that this is absolutely a violation of promises, understandings, and just good sense. We don't do this other places. We don't support an independent Kurdistan in Iraq because we know it would create regional chaos. We don't support an independent Chechnya in Russia. We don't support an independent Basque state in Spain. In general, we resist pleas from small, passionate minorities who say we want our own state. In this case, we acceded. It's still not clear to me why. And the violence that we saw in Serbia, I think, illustrates that this is going to be a hard one for people to swallow.
Mm. Yeah,
please, Jack.
I couldn't agree more. I'm working on a book about 1914. And, of course, Russia mobilized against Austria-Hungary in 1914 because of our brother Slavs in Serbia. Austria-Hungary had declared war on Serbia. And that mobilization of Russia started the great cataclysm of World War I. Russia, you cannot treat a great power the way this country and the West have been treating Russia consistently. In this instance, this is part of their sphere of influence for time immemorial, and the expansion of NATO right up to Russia's borders. And consistently, the West has been treating Russia as if it is not the great power that it remains. And I fear for the future with this kind of conduct. And I agree that this this, and I think the Spanish government wants no part of this separatist because they've got a Basque problem. A lot of countries have these Basque problems. But I just worry about this treatment of Russia. Just before he died, George Kennan, who's the wisest person I've read on this subject, was raising this issue about how we have treated Russia since the Cold War and warning that this is how you create nationalist reactions in countries by pushing them around. Mm.
Let's go to the phones now and go first to North Liberty, Iowa. Brandon is on the line. Brandon, welcome to the conversation. Hello.
Hello. I was hoping for everyone's take on the recent satellite shoot down and missile test and the events leading up to it. In particular, I wanted to get everyone's take on what President Bush said about them doing it first in reference to China. And then also, following the satellite being shot down, how... It was reported that the target was hit as intended, which hit the satellite part, but not necessarily the tanker part, which was initially given as the purpose for it being shot down. And I was just curious if, to me it seems obvious that it was more of a missile test and destroying the technology rather than the, protecting the interests of the public or the safety of the public like had been...
Brandon, thank you for your call. Let's get to the panel. Let me first, though, play a clip from the U.S. General Cartwright, who's explaining here how and why the military shot down that satellite.
Our objective was to intercept the satellite, reduce the mass that might survive reentry, vector that mass as best we could into unpopulated areas, ideally the ocean, breach the hydrazine tank so that we could vent the hydrazine off the toxic fuel, and then have all of that done prior to impact.
David Ignatius, some controversy surrounding this operation, as the caller alluded to. What's your perspective on it?
Well, we have a new weapon system. And so you have to think, is that valuable to the country's security? What are the destabilizing aspects? I think in terms of the fundamental question of national security, which is survivability of the nation and its institutions, there's no question that the assets that are in space are part of our ability to communicate, part of our ability to maintain electronic transactions. You know, we are a digital society and world, and a lot of the hardware spins around the globe, and so the question of it being at risk to others who might attack in space and being able to defend against that, it's just an inevitable military question. I also have to admit that in a world where Iran is developing ever more efficient missiles, which will soon be able to deliver warheads that have chemical or biological, if not nuclear, weapons, the idea of having some kind of way to defend against that seems to me valuable. So to see a Navy cruiser shoot something out of low orbit suggests that those defenses, which sometimes have seemed kind of half-baked, not for real, are actually coming along a little bit better. And I don't think that's a bad thing either. I do think this raises lots of very, very complicated questions. And countries like China that feel very passionately about this, Russia as well, are going to have to be brought into a discussion about this next frontier. Let's face it, this next frontier of military competition.
Gene Cummings, I want to get your perspective on all this from the campaign trail, where you are and have been. What are the candidates talking about, related to these big international stories?
Well, a lot of this news is very fresh, and so we haven't gotten a whole lot of substance from them. There was a moment in last night's debate, though, where we saw a clear distinction between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, where she said she would not meet with the new leader of Cuba until there was clear evidence of an opening and movement towards democracy and that sort of thing. And Barack Obama said he would. And so we now have, we don't have many, we have only a handful of really clear distinctions. Now we have a new one that voters can analyze and decide which they prefer. I think, though, in broadly, what's happened in the past week with all of these hot spots popping up is that it reminds us how quickly the campaign field and the agenda of a president can be changed by events outside of their control. That's the sort of thing where it can become a real game changer in an election. And if we have a lot of this sort of thing happening next fall, and say the race is McCain versus Barack Obama, the election could suddenly tilt towards McCain with his experience and, you know, that sort of thing. So, you know, it's a reminder that these elections are very, very fluid and can be subject to quick changes based on outside events. Mm.
Thanks, Jean. Richard now is calling from Newton, Massachusetts. Hi, Richard. Welcome to the program.
Hello, Jane. Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
On the subject of supporting somebody, a country, against Russia, we supported Poland. Russia owned most of it for well over 100 years. We supported Czechoslovakia. We supported Hungary in 56. So there's no reason why we can't support somebody against Russia. They are not a good country. And I don't see why we can't support Kosovo. They've been mistreated by the Serbs for a long time.
Richard, thank you. Jack Beatty?
Well, of course, that was in the context of the Cold War, when these governments were saddled with effectively Soviet-propped dictatorships. I'm not saying we need to respect everything about Russia. I'm just saying if you back away from the morals of these cases, and by the way, those are always somewhat gray, and you just look at it coldly in terms of international relations, we would look with disfavor upon Russia if it were, recognizing a separatist movement in Central America or something like that. I mean, you know, countries have the map means something in international relations. And if you just look at the map, you see the connection between Serbia and Russia. And if you just look at history, the Slavic connection is very strong indeed. It was the Russian Orthodox Church that brought Orthodoxy to Serbia. Russian volunteers streamed into Serbia in the 1870s to help it in its war against Turkey. So, you don't want to, it seems to me, you don't want to, as David said, stumble into situations where your stake is so much smaller, at least symbolically, than the other guy's stake.
I want to turn to the economy for a moment now. David Ignatius, you wrote a terrific piece in the Washington Post this week about the U.S. economy, and I ask you now to explain why our economic woes may be worse than we think.
Well, it's a complicated subject, but just very briefly, what I see happening in financial markets, really out of the view of most of us, thank goodness, because it would scare us, is a withdrawal by very large players, financial institutions, that have been burned by the credit crisis that began in the subprime mortgage area. And have had often to write down significant losses. The financial institutions have written down well over $100 billion in subprime losses, but it's argued that that may be as little as a quarter of what they may ultimately have to write down. And as this process has spread, the financial engineering that was developed in the 1990s and in this decade that would take lots of little loans, you know, it would take a thousand mortgage loans, package them together into a great big security worth $1 billion that could then be traded, that you could slice it up into different pieces, sell pieces to people who have different risk appetites. The same thing was done for every kind of debt, for the kind of receivables that merchants have, for student loans. Just go down all the lists of categories. This was done because it generated fees and slightly more larger returns. What's happened is that people suddenly, as things begin to turn down, cannot value those assets that they're holding. They don't know what value to put on them. They don't know how to sell them. When they try to sell them, the spread between what they want to get for it, what someone is willing to offer, is huge. And that's why in these exotic financial markets, a lot of activities come to a standstill. And it really is beginning to worry people who look carefully at this. Martin Wolf, very respected Financial Times columnist, wrote this week that the United States could be looking at the mother of all financial meltdowns. We had a similar essay this morning by Floyd Norris looking at panics in financial markets and what can be done about them in the New York Times. So this is a very uncomfortable subject. I don't mean to be alarmist about it. I'm just saying that your listeners should realize that among people who look carefully at financial markets, there's a good deal more worry than you might think.
Gene, with the turn of attention to the economy on the campaign trail, how are the candidates stacking up and responding?
Well, the candidates are focused mostly at a very populist level. And so they're talking about the housing crisis from the perspective of the homeowner who's about to lose their home. They have they're talking a lot about these things these days because they're in Ohio, where we've seen so much. We've seen not only high record levels of foreclosures. I believe Ohio is ranked sixth in the nation in terms of foreclosures based on the housing meltdown. But we also, of course, have higher unemployment here. And so their messages are twofold, to help the homeowner who may lose their home, to try to bring an end to predatory lending, and then on the other hand, to try to deal with job loss and training, retraining workers who've lost jobs that have gone overseas. Their plans are very similar. There are some distinct differences. Hillary Clinton talks about putting a freeze on foreclosures and then a freeze on subprime interest rates moving up, something that many experts in the housing field say could make the situation on Wall Street even worse, the situation David spoke of. And it's funny, when I read David's column, right about the same time I had lunch with a credit union expert, and he said they're seeing upticks in missed payments on all kinds of things, including cars and credit cards, and that this indeed is much deeper than we think.
More to come. Listen, I want to thank everyone on our panel for a really terrific discussion today. From the Politico, Gene Cummings, thanks so much for your time, Gene. Good luck on the trail.
Thank you.
From the Washington Post, David Ignatius. As always, David, thank you.
Great to be with you, Jane.
Thank you. And Jack Beatty, always good to have you, Jack. Thanks.
My pleasure.
You can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.